Good morning. On today's programme, the threat faced by Sudanese refugees in Tunisia and to the United States, where the Iowa caucuses signalled the beginning of the US presidential campaign. But first we go to Denmark, where today marks the end of an era. The Queen is abdicating, and her son will take over as king. It's the first abdication in nearly 900 years and marks an historic change in the Danish royal family. From Denmark, Tom Carstensen reports.
The Queen's speech on New Year's Eve at 6 p.m. has for many years been a national gathering moment. Even monarchy skeptics and Republicans do tend to watch and listen in great numbers. Because there is something about Queen Margrethe. She's brought the nation together on many occasions. And she has in her speech several times, very directly, told us off when she thought we as a people were being too self-centered, too unkind to immigrants, or showed other human traits she doesn't approve of. And it's hardly ever been something people got mad about. She is in many ways seen as the mother of the nation, much more so than the people in actual power, PMs and other ministers. Because it's very important to note that the royal family in Denmark holds no actual political power. They are only symbolic. The last time a king tried to meddle in politics in Denmark is known as the Easter Crisis. That was Queen Margrethe's grandfather, King Christian X. He fired the then Prime Minister because he was unhappy with some of the government's politics. On paper, he had the power to do so, but it hadn't been done for many years, and it was looked upon as against the Danish constitution by the governing party and their support. It meant large demonstrations, and the unions called for a general strike. This changed the king's mind. And that was the last time a monarch meddled in politics in that manner. Since then, they have in reality only been symbolic. But we still do listen to the queen when she once in a while lifts her finger and gives us a bit of a telling off. Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen of the Social Democrats was in her youth very skeptical of the concept of a monarchy. But in her own New Year's speech this year, she said that Queen Margrethe had made her a royalist. Many Danes feel that way. The monarchy was not as strong before she took over 52 years ago. Her father was never as popular a king as she would become a queen. The first queen without a king for more than 600 years, since Margrethe I, who died in 1412, Margrethe II has renewed the life of the Danish monarchy, perhaps even saved it. And it actually took a national vote for her to become queen, as the old Danish constitution only allowed for a king. But she had no brothers, and the count that was in place to become king was very unpopular in Denmark. Not many wanted him as a king. So Margrethe took over, but now it's the last day of her reign. In her New Year's speech, she took the whole country by surprise. I myself uttered words not fitting for repeat on air in bafflement. Because most Danes had never imagined her abdicating, and she is the first monarch to do so in nearly 900 years. But she recently went through major surgery, and has now decided that her last year should not be as busy as the last 52, and it would be hard to find a Dane that thinks she doesn't deserve it. Luckily, she's got the pair to take over lined up, and it's important to empathize that it's a pair. It's Frederik, to be named king, today in front of more than 50,000 people in central Copenhagen, on a balcony, in Parliament, facing a massive square. But it's also his wife, Princess Mary, to be Queen Mary today. She's extremely popular in Denmark. She's originally Australian, and they married 20 years ago. Frankly, she's probably been a large factor in saving the coming king's popularity. Before he met her, he was known as a bit of a scandal prince. Drunk driving and a bit too much partying was on the menu for a while. But he also manned up and became a soldier in the most elite Danish military force, similar to American Navy SEALs. And Mary's grace and work with children in hospitals and her Mary Foundation that combats bullying has definitely helped the family's popularity. The four children that are all very charming, headed by from today Crown Prince Christian, has also helped. For RTE World Report in Copenhagen, this is Tom Carstensen.
Next to Tunisia, where some 1.2 million Sudanese people are located, having fled Sudan's civil war. Constantly under threat of forced expulsion and violence by Tunisian security forces, they find strength within their own community of exile and have created a temporary place of safety. But they're under constant threat of having their informal camp torn down and being expelled into the deserts of Algeria or Libya by security forces. Reporter Elysia Volkman has more from Tunis.
Winter in Tunisia is cold, wet and miserable, even more so if you've walked all the way from Sudan in nothing but flip-flops. A camp built in a small park in a suburb of Tunis is home to around 100 refugees, mostly Sudanese from Darfur. They shelter and shiver in little makeshift cube-shaped houses and under awnings they've constructed from found materials and bright blue plastic sheeting donated by a visiting German NGO. But this is no ordinary camp. Over the past 4 months, the refugees have built a tiny village, complete with shops and canteens to feed their newly formed community. There is a tailor's workshop where a tailor works a foot treadle sewing machine to make adjustments to donated clothes. A tiny barbershop offering haircuts and grooming offers both style and dignity to its customers who admire the results in a small mirror. But the largest building is their white plastic-covered mosque. It's dinner time, so most people are hanging out under awnings, stirring steaming pots of stew or frying fish in spicy batter, accompanied by fresh salads. Tea and coffee is kept warm in thermos jugs, and a sweet date and spice smoothie is on offer. They take pride in their cooking. For them, food is not just a question of survival of the body, but of their culture and courage. It's a taste of home. Biko takes his nickname from the South African anti-apartheid activist Steve Biko. He's been here in Tunisia for 4 months. He told me he has fled his home in Darfur shortly after graduating as an electrical engineer. He said he was lucky as he managed to graduate, but many students have been forced to abandon their university studies. Biko's friends told me they took the long route through neighbouring Chad to Niger into Algeria, and the last leg was through western Libya, where they had to dodge the notorious militia who regularly kidnap and ransom sub-Saharan migrants for money. The International Organization for Migration, IOM, says that since the war began back in April 2023, some 1.2 million people have fled the fighting and millions more are internally displaced. Sudanese journalists are calling it the Forgotten War. According to the UN Humanitarian Affairs Office, as of December 2023, 12,000 people have been killed and an estimated 33,000 injured. Darfur and Sudan's capital Khartoum have seen the most intense fighting, but Crisis Group warns that as Rapid Support Forces, the paramilitary group opposed to the government's army, expands into the east of Sudan, into cities such as El Madina, the widening of the conflict is creating more internally displaced people and refugees. Biko and his friends tell me that they don't feel that they have a country anymore, that the politicians, the government's army, and the Rapid Support Forces are carving up the country, and that the Sudan they grew up in is no more. They told me that they aren't just refugees. They feel stateless. But their problems haven't ended since arriving in Tunisia. The people in this camp fear that the camp could be torn down by police at any moment. Biko said many Sudanese, even those with refugee cards given by UNHCR, have been forcibly expelled into the deserts of Algeria and Libya. He said that he knows that three of their friends have died in Libya. As tough as life is in this camp, they are the lucky ones. Further south in Tunisia, thousands of refugees and migrants struggled to survive in makeshift shelters in the olive groves south of the city of Sfax. This winter has seen several violent clashes between refugees and police, and tensions are high between refugees and locals, and even amongst themselves. In these remote places, finding food, water, and medical care is a daily toil. Agencies such as IOM and UNHCR struggle to gain access to support them as Tunisia's government is growing increasingly hostile to foreign organisations. Back in Tunis, Biko and his friends tell me that the hardest thing for them is that they cannot speak to their families because the network in Sudan is virtually non-existent. Biko says that he hasn't spoken to his family in 4 months. He doesn't know if they're alive or dead, if they're in Sudan, or if, like him, they have fled. For RTE, this is Elysia Volkman in Tunis, Tunisia.
Finally, to the United States. Tomorrow, Republicans in the U.S. state of Iowa will vote for their preferred candidate for the 2024 presidential election. The Iowa caucuses signal the start of a frenetic series of competitions across U.S. states to select the presidential nominees. One of the most intriguing of which will take place in Florida, where two of those on the ballot paper are residents, former President Donald Trump and Governor Ron DeSantis. But as Connor Power reports, despite DeSantis being a Florida native, there's little expectation that he'll spring a surprise.
Miami is America's lucky city. Summer all year round, long sandy beaches and with an abundance of fresh water. Florida's largest metropolis is a major North American center for the arts, and its lifestyle draws people from a variety of countries and backgrounds. Walking its streets, you'll notice that Spanish and not English is the language of the majority. And yet, in spite of appearances, Florida is a haven of conservatism. In Miami, there's very little sign yet of any palpable political tension, but the 2024 American presidential race is about to step up a gear with the January 15th caucuses in Iowa, where Republican Party members are voting for their choice of presidential nominee. As things stand, two Florida residents are in the running. On paper, the leading local candidate is State Governor Ron DeSantis. A decorated war hero and highly qualified and experienced lawyer, 45-year-old DeSantis looks like the answer to conservative America's prayers. A leader who shoots from the hip, but in the form of a more erudite, better educated and younger version of Donald Trump. And then there's the actual local leading candidate, Donald Trump, who has a residence at Mar-a-Lago, 1 hour north of Miami. DeSantis has been working very hard to show just how Trump-like he is. Like Trump, he's seen by many as a refreshing kickback against the ill-defined philosophy commonly referred to as wokeism. He recently championed a bill in Florida that precludes gender identification issues from being discussed with children in class from kindergarten to third grade level, i.e. 8 to 9 year olds. Furthermore, he has made it his mission to remove all such references at all levels of education. DeSantis has also remained strongly opposed to the practice of historic whitewashing. Here in Ireland, we've seen Trinity College in Dublin rename the former Berkeley Library because of philosopher George Berkeley's association with and promotion of slavery. For some, such movements are seen as a positive way of ensuring that historical characters from the past are rightfully stripped of such permanent honours for their sins. For others, however, such practice is futile in the face of so many sins, which may not have even been seen as sins by society's past, and which may not even be seen as sins by certain in society's present. In the USA, the issue of slavery is an open wound that may never close. First American President George Washington not only kept slaves in his household, he even wore false teeth partially manufactured from slaves' teeth. Yet his image will surely be forever synonymous with the founding of the world's most powerful democracy, and his face is extremely unlikely to ever be removed from dollar denominations. In Florida, as in many southern states of the US, slavery and the Civil War are particularly thorny issues. The Civil War produced no shortage of heroes on the southern side, all of whom would have had their hands sullied by slavery, and none of whom would have the international stature of a George Washington to give them immunity from postmodern condemnation. A recent poll amongst Floridians showed that some 60% of all voters support a law that would protect historical monuments and memorials, including some for soldiers who fought for the Confederate States of America. Only Democrat voters oppose the law, and even amongst them, 28% would be in favour of monument protection, according to the survey carried out by polling company Signal. What is difficult to understand about DeSantis is that he's still nowhere near as popular as Trump, in Florida or anywhere else in the US. In spite of his willingness to successfully and legally fight issues such as monuments protection and wokeism, despite his clean-cut record, his qualifications and his ability to express himself in a clear and coherent manner, American right-wing voters seem to only want Trump. In advance of the Iowa caucuses, polls indicate that DeSantis will not only be outdone by Trump in this first hurdle for presidential nomination, but he could even see himself overtaken by recent debate rival and former South Carolina governor Nikki Haley. Perhaps in another era, Ron DeSantis would have been a runaway winner for the Republican Party's presidential race ambitions against someone approaching 80 who defies authorities and who, in words of DeSantis, spews word vomit on social media. Time will tell, and Trump may yet be barred from competing. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is the piece of legislation being used to try to prevent Donald Trump from contesting the November presidential election because of his alleged involvement in insurrection. It's interesting to note that this law was brought in immediately after the end of the Civil War to prevent former members of the pro-slavery Confederacy from holding office. Perhaps the reason behind this apparent political anomaly goes back to that open wound of slavery after all. For RT World Report in Miami, Florida, this is Connor Power.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.